Relationship Psych, the podcast, helping you design the relationship you want. With couples therapy costing a pretty penny, Relationship Psych gives you access to couples therapy insights without spending a dime. Tune in for discussions on communication, managing conflict, recovering from infidelity, attachment, and more. I'm your host, Amber Dawson. I'm a psychologist and couples therapist. A few of my favorite things are my husband, grapes, and my adorable little dog, Riggs. Simply by listening, you're going to get tools to help you and your partner create a loving and harmonious relationship that can withstand the test of time. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be misconstrued for specific relationship advice. For advice for your specific relationship, seek out a local couples therapist in your area. Welcome back to Relationship Psych, the podcast. Today I have on us an exciting guest that I feel like we're going to just have a really good connecting conversation that goes deep into the soul, hopefully. I have Nikita Renthigben, who's on a mission to build stronger families that leave new multi-generational imprints, witness from the ripples of love, empathy, adventure, victory, and edify they create their self-actualized wholeness. She's the number one balanced relationship advisor in the world, activating power couples and potent humans who privately identify with witty tongue-in-cheek humor as lazy overachievers. I would say I'm a lazy overachiever. Like how little can I do with the maximum results? Who doesn't want to be that, right? But also leads to a lot of work. But I'm digressing here. So most of our clients, founders, entrepreneurs that want to rest, recharge, and have bliss, and also do a lot of really amazing stuff. So we're going to have a great conversation about relationships that might lead us into business, mental health, just all sorts of things so that you can work less, trust more, and probably have a better relationship. So welcome to the show. I'm super excited for our conversation today.
Well, thank you so much, Amber. You know, I've told you I professionally stalked you, so I've been waiting for this conversation on air.
Fantastic. I love being professionally stalked. It is one of my faves. All right, cool. So what made you decide to get into the world of working with those lazy, maybe lazy overachievers who also want to have great relationships? How come this is personally relevant to you?
Oh, yeah. So how much time do we got? similar background to you, we are two peas in the pods. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and trauma specialist and relationship expert for over 20 years before my husband and I started our business 12 years ago. At the time of this recording, that was just 2 weeks ago. We just hit our biz-iversary. And when we started, we did not start in this vein. I started from a very logical space as a staffing agency that had a professional development arm, always with the mission has never changed. I wanted to build stronger families, which is very deeply rooted, connected to me not having one growing up. I grew up in a very dysfunctional house. If for all of you who are listening, if you're familiar with the adverse child experience score, unfortunately, I had the highest score because I've had every single adverse experience you could have imagined as a child. So high is not good for all of you anal test takers out there. In this case, high is not good. And I wanted to be different. I wanted to do different. I wanted to not just have a great family, which I do. My two children and my two little grandbabies that are 4 and 5 years old are amazing. And I've been able to create a space where they didn't have those generational curses passed down to them. But I wanted to do more. I wanted to spread that love, if you will, to other people. So when we started 12 years ago with the staffing agency and the professional development training arm, it was really, you know, the number one reason for separation and divorce is communication issues / around finances. So I was like, well, let me put some money in your pocket, right? And give you some skills to boost your confidence and help you become whatever it is in the world that you dream to be, and therefore not ruin your family in the process. So logically, my 68-page business plan was like, yes, Nikita, this is on point. You will save the world doing this. The reality was that wasn't in alignment with my deepest skills and my deepest gifts as a trauma specialist and a psychotherapist. And part of it, the reason that I went in such a different direction is because I didn't believe that the world would pay my worth as a trained psychotherapist. And you know this, you know, we're used to a very different experience in that as helpers. You're almost martyred in so many ways. So I put on my most strategic hat and was like, well, this is what it'll be. These are the numbers. This is the bar graph. This is how I can serve. And I quickly beyond the over $100,000 that we lost in our first year in business, I quickly understood I was out of alignment. And that was not the best way to serve a community of people that, from my heart's intent, was to really help them be stronger if I was denying such beautiful, brilliant parts of myself because I didn't think other people would find it worthy. And so slowly but surely, with good coaches and good advisors, a phenomenal therapist of my own, right? Like doing some deeper self-awareness work, self-realization work to actualize who I was. We slowly, it took us about a year and a half to 2 years to truly pivot into the personal development space that we're in now. And I started to attract what I was mirroring, right? I was attracting people who wanted more. I was a little bit further ahead of them in my personal development growth process. And they were looking at me like, who are you? Where did you come from? I want to do that. I want to be that. And that's literally how I started serving people slowly but surely in alignment with my gifts.
Well, I mean, that's beautiful. And I love how you had to describe like a story of pivot and that it wasn't just like straightforward. I know so many people start a business or think about doing something and it doesn't go right the first time, like the first draft wasn't very good or it was good. It just didn't pan out for whatever reason.
Right.
And you weren't like, you tried again. And that's really, I'm going through a season in my business where how I started out, the vision I had for myself isn't currently materializing. And I've had to step back and be like, in this season, that's okay.
Yes.
And I'm not doing what I thought I would be doing, but it's not, I don't know, I'm still doing part of what I do, just the other part isn't, but it feels like this really step back, like, oh, I couldn't, I'll have a thought like I couldn't cut it, or maybe I wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
And I have to step back and evaluate the context of how come I'm not able to do maybe what I was able to do last year or the year before, which can be really challenging for a high achiever to not like hit what you think your target air quote should be.
Yes.
And I deeply relate like in that helping space to not thinking like your skills are worthy or that others are going to find them valuable. And then to put, I mean, I think just people relate to that probably in general too, that aren't helpers. Like, oh, I can make this beautiful bracelet or paint this thing. Like, is that worthy? Is that valuable? And because we do it, a lot of us second guess that skill, right?
Yeah.
But it provides value to others, but it's so hard to see that in yourself sometimes.
It is. Givers often, and just my professional and personal experience, we give until we are emotionally broke. And that's not okay. But there's a part of us that, you know, we will justify out loud, like, I just want to help people. I'll do it for free. Like, yeah, but, you know, I live outside of Philadelphia. We have Pico for our electric, you know, electricity. My helping you for free is not paying my bill. It's not paying my light bill. It's not putting food in my refrigerator. It's not allowing me to put my kids through college or to have the experience that I want them to have so they don't end up in dysfunctional relationships like my mother did or my grandmother did and so on and so forth. Like that multi-generational trauma that continues to cycle itself when you literally sink yourself in this bubble of this is what it should be. These expectations that you and I were talking in the green room that are expired because we will justify it based on what our community and your community can be your household, your neighborhood, your school, right? Like it can go out into the greater culture experience, but we will justify not growing, not allowing ourselves to stretch, not breaking the box that our families are in because this is what we do. This is who we are. Like we're helpers. Like I can help you and have a beautiful life and not have to worry that I don't know how many coins are in my couch to fill the gas tank, right? Like all experiences that I had at some point as a medical clinical social worker and a trauma specialist helping so many families and thinking, how am I going to get gas in the car to get back to work tomorrow? That's not okay. And something had to be different. And it wasn't just about, because I'm not monetarily driven, but money does matter and money is a tool. But at the time, I didn't see it that way. It was just like, I'm doing all this help. You get the pats on the back from your, you know, your clients and partners and supervisors, depending on the organizational structure you work in. And you're like, thank you. Good job. Oodles and noodles again, right? You know, with all the things that you're taking home with you. And I just wanted a different experience. I didn't want to stay under this misnomer that I had to be a starving artist, if you will, to be a helper. I knew that I could help everyone that I was drawn to help, the people I want to play with the most, which for me are those power couples and potent humans that happen to be women founders and entrepreneurs, that's who I want to play with. And many of them have money to invest in the services. And those who don't, I get the benefit in my philanthropic side of what I do to make sure that I seed money into scholarships for people that I also want to play with that aren't quite at that level financially in that hour of their life, so I can help them with the various ways that I do that.
Well, it sounds like you've done a lot of work to think about how do you want to show up, what would be in alignment, and how can you serve in various ways, given that, like you said, you're not money driven, but it matters.
It does.
Yeah. So you talked about early in your story, like that high ACEs score, wanting to create something different for yourself, something different to pass down to your kids.
Yeah.
And I've heard you say things just kind of like, you know, this is the way we are. Mm-hmm. What do you think were some of the steps you had to take personally to step out of identifying like this is the way it is and begin to build this life for yourself that is different than what you grew up with?
Ooh, honey, great question. There's so many layers to that. So when I was 9 years old, I had what I understand now was a spiritual download. I didn't understand it at nine. It was just something that kind of came to me in the moment. I caught my mother doing drugs. She was doing drugs in the back room. We were in a bunk bed in my grandparents' house, all the things. And she used to hide it in this knockoff Louis Vuitton duffel bag with everything. I remember, you know, dating myself a little bit, but I remember the Dare Bear, like, you know, when schools were doing like, right, don't do drugs. Yeah, like the commercial, they would come to the schools and the big animal suits, all that. So I'm like team spirit with everything. So I got the Dare shirts. I have all this stuff. And I remember one of the nights.
Seeing people with Dare shirts. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Like, right. D-A-R-E. Like we were so serious about it, rocking the spirit. And I remember one of the nights, many nights, my mother didn't come home for whatever reason. And I was bored because what do children do when they're bored? They start going through stuff and putting their hands in things that they shouldn't. And she had these big old school popcorn tin cans that she would stuff inside the knockoff LV bag. And there used to be like 50 cent pieces, 50 cent coins that were in there that I would steal. And I would treat the neighborhood kids to all kinds of food and candy because this was my penance, right? My mother is not giving me attention. I'm going to get attention from the neighborhood kids by buying everyone penny candy from the local store.
Makes perfect sense.
Right? Makes perfect sense. So one day, and I hadn't gone in for a while because I had got in trouble a few weeks earlier. I went in and I found the towel wrapped with her drug paraphernalia. And I knew she was smoking. I knew she was doing this because I would smell the scents. My bed was the top bunk. She was below. I knew everything was wrong, but I never had proof to, because she was very skilled at where she hid things until she left me with this abundance of time to go through her things. And I remember finding it and deciding, I gotta say something. I gotta help. In my head as a 9-year-old kid, I gotta save my mom. So I went downstairs to my grandparents, my grandmother and her husband, my step-grandfather, and took the bag and was like, this was in mommy's closet. And of course they opened it, they find it, whole argument ensues. My step-grandfather is obviously not my mother's father. So it's all this is your kid, this is your daughter, look what she's doing, you know, stuff that's happening. My mother walks in the middle of this conversation and they, you know, confront her. What are you doing? You can't do this in my house, all of it. The shortest version of the story is they threatened her with, you have to go get help. You have to go away and, you know, go into a recovery program or you can't live here. And she said, well, I'm just leaving. And they said, well, you can't take, my childhood name is Kia. You can't take Kia with you if you do it. And she looked at me. I'm sitting at the top of the steps, like scared because I got her in trouble, right? I'm having all the feelings, like glad that they know, but also scared, you know, what's going to happen to my mom. And it's a physically violent house on top of everything else. So I'm like, not sure what's really going to happen. And she looks me dead in the face and said, keep her, and walks out the door. Oh. And in that moment, sitting at the top of the steps, my heart sank. And the first thing that came into my spirit, not understanding all that woo-woo stuff at the time, was, I have to be 75% different. And that was a rule that stayed with me the rest of my life. Didn't really understand all the layers of it until I got older, had therapy, all of it. But I remember saying, I have to be 75% different. Why 75% at that time? Not understanding there were good things that came from my family. I learned hygiene. I learned, you know, there was certain small things that came that were very positive in my life, but 75% of it was not great at all. And I just didn't want to be a repeat of my mother. My father was in and out of jail, like all the things. And that is what stayed with me. Now, mind you, I was a rebellious teen. I got into a lot of trouble. Like I was not this, you know, cookie clean cutter little kid or by any means. I was always fighting, scrapping. I'm from Philly, right? Like all the things that I'm getting in trouble, not processing my emotions well, like all the things I got to understand later. But what stayed with me is don't cross a line because you have to be 75% different. And that was huge for me. It carried with me when I decided for the first time to be selfish when I was 15. I had moved back in with my mother when I was 12, when she was pregnant with my youngest brother. I'm the oldest of five, but the other kids are my dad's. And I remember saying, I can't stay here. I'm going to go to jail. I'm going to be underneath the jail. She was trying to sell me for sex, for drugs. Like there was just so many different things that were happening living with her. And I literally was like, I have to go. So I called my grandmother, which was also a chaotic and toxic environment, but was safer compared to where I was because dysfunction and dysfunction, you know, which devil is worse. And I remember saying like, we have to come back. We need somewhere to stay. And she's like, I'm not raising nobody else's kids. Like your brother can't come. And he was 3 and a half at that time. And I was devastated because I'm 15. I work 3 jobs. I go to school full time. I'm in cheerleading. I'm in cross country track. I'm doing all the things that you're trying to do as a young person, trying to literally stay off the streets. And I'm parentified because I'm basically raising this little boy. But I know that I can't live with him on my own. I knew we would be in the system or worse. So I chose myself. And it was the hardest thing I had ever had to do up until that point, and probably the hardest thing I had to do into my 40s. I'm a little bit older than that now. But it stayed with me. And it was a challenging decision to be selfish, to save myself. But that 75% different was what came up for me. Like, you can't do this if you have a 3-year-old on your hip. They're not going to keep you together, right? In the system, you're going to end up in foster care, all the things. And we had some aunties and things that loved us, but everyone was young. Everyone was starving. Everyone was trying to stay out of the systems in their own way themselves. So I literally had nowhere to go. And I had to go back to my grandmother's house, but I couldn't take him. And that was my road to different.
I mean, it sounds like from the moment of that download, 75% different, you went on many journeys. There's a side of you that knew you were going to have to be different. So having 3 jobs, being on the cheer squad, like doing all those things to proactively move towards a different future. And then we have the side of you that maybe, you know, I'm going to put words in your mouth, so correct them if you think they're wrong, but like the side of you that maybe didn't know how to be different or was just in rebellion or was just a teenager in a
all of the above,
like chaotic environment. Mm-hmm. Who was just doing normal, a little bit rebellious stuff and maybe a little bit more rebellious given the circumstance you were in. And it sounds like there was this 2 different parts of you kind of like in push and pull.
Yeah.
But that download or variations of it stayed with you, that you knew you were going to have to make a change.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a devastating and gut-wrenching decision to have to make, but you knew deep down if you didn't make a change, you weren't going to get to be 75% different or things were going to go worse for you.
Oh, absolutely. I literally could see, you know, how people say that they can like have those dissociative out of body experiences where you can see, I could see my other life path and it was either dead, which would have been the easier path, or I was going to literally be Amber underneath somebody's jail because of the things that I was going to have to do to survive in my circumstances or some version of survival. And the other path, which was blurry, it wasn't clear. It wasn't easy to see. I didn't say like, oh, I'm just going to be this powerful person. Like it wasn't like this beautiful other experience. It was different than the path that was very clear, dead or in jail. Like it was very clear that I didn't have any other choices. And it was so horrific on so many levels is the best way to experience it, you know, to state it. It did lead me to be a lover of love, to say the least. That's something that stayed with me. And part of it was because I wanted the love that I didn't have, right? Like I wanted safe love. I wanted, you know, to feel embraced and not be worried about what was going to happen. My husband and I have been friends since 13 and together since 17. We're going on our 24 year anniversary this year and 29 years together. And I remember when we were pregnant with my oldest now, my oldest son is about to be 27. And we had this very mature conversation, big and pregnant. I was probably 5 or 6 months in my dorm because I was that kid that was knocked up in college, right? And I remember saying to him, you know, we have to choose right now what kind of parents we're going to be together or not, because I don't want us to stay together just for a kid. That would ruin me. It would ruin you. And we have to be very clear about what our, I actually use the term non-negotiables are. Didn't even really understand the high value of what that word and that phrase would mean for me. And my non-negotiable has and still is, I can never feel unsafe. We can argue, we can fuss, we can have all kinds of conflict, right? We can increase that conflict intimacy muscle all day long. What we will not do is make me feel unsafe. And I meant that not just physically, but emotionally as well. And that was the line that was very clear at what were we, 18 and a half years old before my son got here, 18 years old, this is what it is. And for him, he's like, I need to be able to trust you. It's just that simple. And here we are.
Wow. So it sounds like continued little moments of downloads happened to you along the way. Mm-hmm. And you have this moment, 18-ish and quite pregnant, where you asked a very important question that so many parents don't ask, like what kind of parents we want to be. An experience in my practice I see from a lot of parents is they like next step, have kids. Maybe they take like a childbirthing course or something, but they don't talk about how do they want to be parents? How do they want to be partners? Things like that.
Yeah.
They don't ask those kinds of questions. And then I see them a couple of years later when things have kind of gone awry, but you asked a really important question. Like, we have to choose what parents will we be? And you ask questions about your non-negotiables and you laid those out for each other. You got clear on what you were going to do. And so what was it like putting in that you needed to be safe and he needed to trust you? What was it like putting those into practice?
That was tough because my husband, who has his own story, right? Like his own journey, his father was an architect, his mother, who I love, who is my mama, you know, my mother in love to this day, was a stay-at-home mom for 40 plus years. She didn't go to college until my husband's the baby, till we went to college. Like it was a very different environment and it wasn't perfect Patty, right? Like he had his own challenges, but that was a very different experience than the one that I was coming from and all the layers of baggage and sexual assault and rape and domestic violence and all the things that I had experienced. And that's who he was paired with. Like he was paired with this young human who was not at that time, at that hour in my life, I was Olympic champion of compartmentalization. Like completely, I should have the biggest award in the world, you know, at that time in my age of just stuffing, not addressing, and overcompensating by being a high achiever because pats on the back again, got some love. It's like using the coins and buying everybody candy. Like, right. Oh, kid did what? Right. Like it was all of that. And, you know, fortunately, unfortunately, and I say this from a reflecting and celebratory mindset now, and as a mature human, he was married to someone who was literally not admitting all the things that she was going through, but it was seeping out. Because you know, like I know, Amber, when you get into those relationships and the closer the person gets to you, you can't hide. When they're visiting you for an hour a day or a couple hours or spending a couple nights, that's different. 24/7 with Nikita Thigpen or Nikita Webster at the time. And now, you know, my nightmares are coming out. He's hearing me scream and have conversations out loud that I didn't even know were inside of me in the middle of night. He's hearing all of these different things. He's getting this cold version of me when I can't process my emotions because I wasn't in therapy at that time. I couldn't afford it. That's just what it was. All of those layers. And he's looking at me like, what the hell did I get into? what is going on? And why are you not talking to me? And there was obviously some things he was privy to because, again, we were teenagers together, you know, small neighborhoods and all that stuff. There's only so much you can hide when you have a very chaotic family. But the deepest layers of it, I had to open up and share with him. And that was hard because I hadn't even shared them with myself. So right. The lived experience of that was like a slow unraveling. And I had to look at what I was presenting. And my husband is amazing, but he is nobody's perfect on, right. on any level. And I had to be clear with myself, what was I willing to repair, like look at for myself to see as repairable, but also not excuse any of his behavior for maybe how he would act or react to certain things that as a teenager, a young man, a new father, that he was also trying to figure out. That was probably the most challenging because younger Nikita was a cut you first, talk later, right? Because of that safety. Younger Nikita was very much, I'm going to jump in your face and make it very clear that you are not going to get the best of me. And right. that was hard for him because that's not how he was raised. He was not raised with that kind of physical energy at him. And he had to speak up and make it very clear. I remember, and a lot of people listening to this will be like, what? I remember the first time I got, first and only time that I actually got in his physical face, like in his proximity, like cutting off his proximity, actually. And I was like, blah, 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 you know, whatever I was yelling at, something really small. And he just looked at me like he backed up his head, but he didn't move his body. He like did a turtle thing and backed up and he looked at me. He was like, you know, my mom didn't tell me not to hit women. And that set with me. I was like, what? Because there was part of me that was like, oh, we gonna die today, right? Like that was part of me that was like, we're going for broke. And the other part of me heard his spirit. I don't want to be in this kind of relationship. This is not what I'm asking for. Right. This is not what we said we would do. And you're putting me in this position where I'm about to defend myself because right. you are all up in my proximity and it's not okay. You don't want me to be in your face. Why is it okay for you to be in mine? Right. And that also was a turning point for me. We were probably, I don't think my youngest who's 22, I don't think she was here yet. So we were probably 22, 23 at that time. And I realized it can't be hypocritical. It can't be that women shouldn't be hit, but men can be, you know, picked on and belittled and, you know, all the things. Like, that's not okay either because right. I have a son. Right. I have a son too. And I wouldn't want a woman with all of her stuff and all of her dysfunction to give that to him and expect him to just take it like a punching bag. So there's never been any physical altercation at all, ever in our entire relationship. But that was the moment where I was like, this could have been a very different relationship. If he would have reacted and responded out of just physical nature and didn't have his mama in his ear, like, I ain't tell you not to hit women, but I also didn't tell you to be a punching bag, right? Like, I right. also didn't tell you to feel unsafe yourself. And I had to make a decision to not repeat what I saw my mother doing right. to the various men in her life, because she was definitely fighting them and pulling out knives and doing all the things. And that was normal for me. As much as I said I didn't want it, I was about to repeat that pattern, but I had to catch it.
Right. And I think, there's such a powerful lesson there. Like, we can go through things and then we behave in ways that are pattern and normal because that's what we've seen. That's what we've been taught.
Yeah.
Again, you both got some download in a moment where you chose a different path. And like, hey, if you're listening to this and you didn't choose a different path in a moment, you can still choose the next path in the next moment. And so often our downloads come in hindsight where we feel regret or remorse for
yes
our behavior. And then we can try to make a change next time. But it sounds like you two have many moments in your partnership where you had to really intentionally choose to not repeat yes. what was normal, what was familiar to you, and to dive into trying something totally new and unknown.
Absolutely. And it's, to your point, it's an intentional choice and it's not always easy. My nervous system was literally calculated to fight. There was no flight. It was fight, 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 go. And fortunately, there was something in me spiritually, is the only thing that I can call it, was saying, your life can be different if you choose it. Mm-hmm. Your life can be different if you choose it. But this is a choice, Nikita. This isn't it's just going to happen. It's not going to all of a sudden fall out the sky and you're just going to be a different way. you have to take this choice breath after breath, hour after hour, moment after moment. And that was extremely hard on so many levels. It took me a while. I probably didn't even actually start counseling for another two and a half years after that particular moment, because I'm rebellious. And sometimes that rebelliousness in my younger years was reckless. Now I'm just rebellious without the recklessness because I get to, you know, leverage it. But at that time it was a slow burn and it took a lot of, what do you really want? And we would even say things like, we can't be a statistic. I don't want to be another statistic. I don't want to be the young Black mom who had a kid who is separated and single. And there's nothing wrong with any of it. It's just not what I wanted for my life. And if it happened, I didn't want it to be because I couldn't get a hold of what my wounds were and how they were spilling out and infecting every area of my life. If I was going to be single, it was going to be a healthy, conscious choice, not a reactive moment.
Again, sounds very intentional, very conscious. So if someone's listening to this and they're like, okay, I'm currently inspired to maybe make some changes, change my multi-generational patterns. What first steps do you think your average person could take to begin making some changes in their conditioning and everything they've ever known?
Honestly, self-awareness is always the first. You have to be aware. Like, I wasn't aware when I was the Olympic champion of compartmentalizing, right? Because you're stuffing and going, you're moving. It's fire after fire. And you're so used to wearing that firefighter suit that it's second skin. You don't even realize that you have it anymore. And you're taking these hits and these cuts and these burns. And it is your normal life, to the point that many of us can't be still with ourselves because we don't know how to not be in firefight mode, whatever that looks like, whether it's fighting, freezing, fawning, like whatever that is for the person listening to this. So first is take a step back. And honestly, it sounds cheeky for anyone who's never done it before. Look at yourself in the mirror. Mirror work is so powerful. It is awkward. It's uncomfortable. You might laugh at yourself. You might immediately start pointing like, oh, I got another mole here, a beauty mark here. You know, you might start doing those things. Catch yourself like, oh, that's not what this is about. This is about looking into my eyes, into the windows of my soul, and speaking to that 95% that makes all the decisions, which is your subconscious, and literally saying things that will help to rewire you like, I love you. You're worthy. You are absolutely supposed to be here in this moment. Everything that you've gone through has prepared you for this moment of change, of acknowledgement, of transformation, and even the capacity to deal with the pain that you might be experiencing in this very hour of your life. This is where you've arrived because you needed to be here. You don't need to keep making the same mistakes, but you need to be here right now so you can evolve and then expand. I would literally start selfishly with looking at yourself and talking to you. And if you get real, you know, real serious about it, start forgiving yourself. Start forgiving yourself for every time you cussed and you fussed and you told somebody off and you thought that they deserved it in a moment, but afterwards you felt a little bad because you knew that you went too far and things escalated, or maybe even the things you didn't say that you were holding inside your body and now you're eating them away, or you're sexing them away, or you're hurting yourself in some other way away. Like, start the forgiveness work is next after acknowledging that you deserve to be here in this very hour of your time.
So you talked about awareness, maybe some mirror work. You talked about saying different messaging to yourself, and you talked about forgiveness. And there's this theme of like maybe being a little selfish that keeps coming up. Tell me more about how come that theme continues to emerge.
Yeah. So I'm a nerd first and foremost. And part of my nerdiness is just because I really love learning. Like I love absorbing different things. When the word selfish downloaded into me back in 2011, when I'm very spiritual, as I'm sure you've heard throughout all of my language, I started praying for like, I know I want to write a book. I want to be an author, but I don't really know what I want to write about. And of course, everyone who knows me is like, girl, your whole life is like a reality TV show. Like you need to, you need to write
Take
about
a section,
that.
Start writing.
Right. Like just pick one. And of course, the thing you're scared of the most is yourself, right? Like, it's the thing that is the most torturous thing to share with the world, to be so vulnerable and so open. So I prayed, you know, asked for guidance, asked for clarity. And the title of the book, I could see the cover of the book. It was literally Selfish. I had a visceral reaction to that. Like, what? Selfish? I'm not selfish. I'm the least selfish person I know. Like, if anything, I'm giving too much of myself, like too much all the time as a helper. And so I did some research and I looked at the lexicon, the etiology of the word, and the word selfish got into our lexicon, our dictionary, because a Pentecostal bishop in the 1600s was approached by a group of women parishioners asking for permission, because that's what you did in the 1600s. You went to your local priest or whoever, asked for permission to do anything different. They asked for permission to not have to be available sexually to their husbands at beck and call. They wanted choice. They wanted to be able to say no. And the bishop basically said, and this is kind of layman's rephrasing, you are selfish if you don't make yourself available to your husbands. You are lucky and it's a privilege. Unless you are on your menses or you are pushing a baby out of your vagina, you need to be available to your husband at all times. That part. So Amber, obviously the feminist in me was like, I don't think so. on so many levels. And I was like, oh, we have to redefine this word that has literally been put in here to shame us. And then I started looking deeper, like, well, why is this word coming up for me? Like, you know, my husband has never just said I have to be available. Like, what is this doing for me? And it was really the shame behind it, because that was my biggest Achilles heel. I had so much shame around my childhood and shame around the 18 plus major traumas that I experienced before I was 24 years old. I had so much shame. So I understood the personal connection to it. And I took it on as a little bit of a personal movement to redefine it. So now I use intentionally selfish as the phrase, as a personal intimate gift to create your joy. So for me, it's about giving yourself that spaciousness. So when people say, oh, it's so selfish, you're not going to this party, you're not coming to this, you know, fifth wedding, you're not making yourself available to me because I need you again, for whatever reason I need you. I'm like, maybe I need to be intentionally selfish and listen to me. I need to look at the firefight suit and start to peel off the layers of it, realizing that I can create a life where I don't have to suit up for every single thing. And I don't have to sleep in that suit and it be a second skin. But I can't do that if I'm, forgive my language, if I'm breastfeeding everybody all the time. I need you to get off of me so I can have a moment to heal and say, okay, woo, chafe nipples. Like, oh, all right, I need a moment. Let me have this time for myself to say, what does Nikita need? Oh, she needs to hydrate. She needs to exercise. She needs to fuel. She needs to know what her desires, not what would make other people happy, not to give smiles on their faces by giving them penny candy, so to speak. But what desire does Nikita have? And you can only do that if you have spaciousness for yourself. 10 minutes, 2 hours, 6 weeks self-lovecations, whatever it is that you need. But I knew that that was important. So that's why I recreated it. And now it's a huge part of what I teach, from the work-life balance and a sustainable business and fulfilling intimate relationships. And of course, for our mental health and well-being. It's like a pivotal foundation of everything that I teach is you got to be more selfish, regardless of the language that you use, but you're doing it so you have the space to do your healing and to fill up and have joy. And then you can overflow without resentment.
I love that last line, to overflow without resentment. So good. And so often when we're giving to everyone, we're breastfeeding everyone, you feel resentful that you're being touched again. You're breastfeeding again. You don't want to do it. You are tired. You're exhausted. It's the last thing you want to do, but just say yes. And then you're resentful.
Yes.
And it's a perpetual cycle. But it sounds like what I love that you said is redefine that selfishness.
Yeah.
Because selfish, like being told you're selfish, can be used as such like a critical, like there's something wrong with you doing this term.
It's a weapon. It's a weapon to shame you out of whatever behavior you're choosing versus the one that you want. And I do distinguish between egotism and being self-absorbed. Like, no one should be self-absorbed. You shouldn't be so in your ego that you're just not empathetic to whatever expression of compassion that someone might need. But you also get to have beautiful, expansive boundaries and say, All right, cousin, who's called me every day for the last 10 years talking about the same relationship that I've been trying, right? Like, and not listening to the thing, like, well, whoever it is that is draining your time and pulling so much from you, which can be your own family and your own kids, even depending on your boundaries or lack thereof, you get to say, give me a moment. Right. This is for me. For many women, we know that moment is typically in the bathroom, which is so sad on so many levels. And if you have little people, you don't even get to go pee by yourself. Like, and it's cute for a second. And then it's like, wait a minute, I really need a moment to just think and let my body do what it needs to do, or not do anything in here and just have a moment to not freak out. But we often give that away because society, our communities, our family culture says, oh, this is just what happens. The dad falls in line. Oh, the kids are going with mom to the bathroom again. Dude, take them with you. Like, let me pee by myself. And I'm picking on kids, but that applies to everything in your work relationships, as well as your friendships. When people feel like you can't have a self-care day without them tagging along. I don't think so. I get to choose when I want a girl time moment and when I just want a power nap and not have anyone touch me energetically, let alone physically.
I love that, energetically or physically. And some people don't think about like what's affecting your energy, but it is that sometimes being alone to recharge, sometimes it's with people to recharge, but it's sounds like within this, you've given yourself permission to tune into what you energetically want or not, whether it's going to the fifth wedding or not going to the fifth wedding or answering that phone call or not, tuning into what would feel good for you.
Yes.
So what was it like to set boundaries initially?
Probably one of the second hardest things I've had to do in my life, next to pushing children out without medication. That was why. I would say setting boundaries was really challenging for me because I had to look at, one, why I wanted the boundary. And like, you know, I want to be very careful with my history and growing up basically with a disorganized attachment style, which for those who are listening is very push and pull is the best way to explain that. You want closeness, but you don't really trust people to get but too close, and you kind of push them away and you do it through your actions or your inactions or whatever's coming up for you. So I had to be very careful that I wasn't going to create a boundary that literally put me in like a saran wrap bubble and kept me from forming healthy, beautiful, reciprocal relationships with whoever I chose to have them with. But I also wanted my boundaries to be expansive enough to allow me to achieve what I wanted to do in life. So for me, it's connected to balance. Like, you know, I'm sure you hear it too, Amber. Balance isn't a thing. It doesn't exist because people are thinking of the 50-50, 70-30, whatever, which I don't agree with. I don't align with. For me, balance is admitting the truth of what you really want over the boundaries you create to achieve that truth as your reality. Part of my truth is I wanted to build a stronger family. I wanted to erase those generational curses that were in my genetics. Epigenetics teaches us that there's 14 years of generational trauma that is in the cell before the baby is even stitched fully together. 14 years of trauma in the cell before they take their first breath. That's a lot. That is a lot to deal with and recognize, even when you're born into a very healthy, you know, conscious, gentle parenting, you know, way of being, you still have whatever was going on both sides of your familial line, your paternal and your maternal. And I wanted something different. If that's what I want, then I have to create boundaries for myself that won't allow me to fall into those patterns that pull me away from that. That means letting my children advocate for themselves without taking it personal and wanting to smack them across the room. That's a boundary for myself, right? And that's hard when you grow up, you know, kids are seen, not heard type environment, and you are really trying to do different. And you have the sassiness of, you know, your little person, or your son is taller than you since he's 12 years old. And he might seem a little bit more assertive than you would like in the moment. And you got to back up and be like, okay, his testosterone is kicking in. Let him have his moment, but still give him that structure and understanding of what respect looks like when you're in a conflict or there's one brewing and you feel your anxiety raising and your body feels like it's betraying you in some ways. all of those things were hard, and my boundaries started from there. I had to also really honestly be honest with what kind of parent I was. I wasn't a nurturing parent growing up because that was hard for me. I didn't have that to model from. I was protective. And my husband had to pick up the slack with that. He had to be more nurturing. His mom is amazing and so nurturing, like the mom that makes you sick, that cooks like 5-course breakfast, lunch, and dinner when they're like 4. Like, what are you doing? But that's what he grew up with, right? Like, that's his person. So he was able to give that to the kids when I couldn't. And I'm hiding in my ambition with all the working and all the schools and all the degrees. So part of the boundary for me was honestly just looking at what was necessary for me to achieve what I said I wanted, to be the 75% different, and not resent myself in the process.
Wow. So it's hard to set boundaries, and there's thought that goes into it, and knowing there's going to be pushback in moments, the boundaries are hard for sure.
Absolutely.
So what have been the benefits? What are some of the benefits to maybe living a bit more intentionally selfish?
Oh my God, there's so many. Well, sex is so much better. That's one.
Great pro.
Right? Like one of the best, because I got to know me. I got to know what I wanted for my body. I teach my power couples and potent humans the same thing. Know yourself so you're not pointing the finger at, well, they're not doing this and our love life isn't the same and our intimacy is so different. Yes, they have responsibility too, but start with you. Have you actually said, I don't like when you do this. I don't like when you touch me here. It used to work when I was younger, but my hormones is different, dude. Like, I'm a different human now. Like, there's a lot that's different for me. My taste, my smell, my pheromones, everything is more mature and more beautiful, not bad, but you have to get to know this version of me. And that's really hard if you're not getting to know that version of yourself. So literally, orgasms are more intense. Sex is so much better. Communication, platonic communication, not just with your romantic partner, I call them your forever lover, but whoever you're intimating with in a relationship where you are being vulnerable and sharing yourself with, you get to be honest with, okay, I feel uncomfortable with that question. There's something that's coming up for me right now that I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I really need us to tie a bow in this conversation before we skip past it like it didn't happen. You get to say that more powerfully and not in an aggressive, angry, attacking way, the way maybe your younger self might have done it because you didn't know what to do with that regulation of your emotions. When you're intentionally selfish because you made that space to do your work, to have fun, to play, to be joyful, to tap into your inner five-year-old. When you've made that space for yourself, you literally get to have intimacy in a 360-degree way that isn't just about sex and emotional intimacy with your physical partner, but now your parenting is different. Your work relations are better. You have better retention with your employees if that's what you're in for business. You have better conversations with your colleagues because now you get to say, oh, Amber, that is a wonderful idea. I am not interested in that. That's great. Thank you for the partnership opportunity or the request to do ABC together. It doesn't align, or I don't have capacity. And you get to not feel any type of way and also say it without being disrespectful about the way someone might be receiving it, because maybe they're not used to no. And that's something else that you get to consider when you create that intentionally selfish time for yourself.
Love that. If people are feeling connected to you, they want to maybe read your book called Selfish. If they want to follow you, find you, learn more about you, where can they do that?
I would say the easiest thing to do is to go to our parent company site, which is thigpro.com, thigpro.com. My favorite place to play is LinkedIn these days. And my youngest daughter works with us and does all kinds of fantastic stuff with our Balance Bully podcast and posted on our Instagram at Ask Nikita. So there's lots of places, but you can get all of that from thigpro.com.
Perfect. We will link that to the show notes so people can find you. Well, you have done such a beautiful job of weaving concepts and ideas into just your personal story without, like, you educated us without really realizing we're being educated. And I really appreciate Thank you. The way you share yourself and open up with vulnerability to share your story that makes it seem like we're just learning about you, except throughout the process of learning about you, we're getting beautiful lessons about ways that we can expand and live our lives more in joy while still achieving. Thank you very much for what you've shared here today.
Thank you, Amber. I am honored by that, and I appreciate you so much.
Thank you for tuning in to Relationship Psych, the podcast put on by Ember Relationship Psychology. If you're looking for more free relationship help or advice that comes straight from the couples therapy room, check out the free resources and the blog at www.emberrelationshippsychology.com.